What's up, everybody? It's Mr. James O'Neill here, keynote speaker and owner of Mastery for All, where we partner with school districts across the country to ensure that all are mastering mathematics by highlighting the brilliance of our Black boys, because if we can get them, we have all. Our motto here is Mastery for All, empowered by Equity for All through the belief of expectations for who? For all, y'all. And if I'm saying y'all, you already know where I'm hailing from, the South, by way of the Queen City, Charlotte, North Carolina. And I am super excited that you decided to join me. So welcome to season 3 of the Mastery for All podcast with myself. I'm excited because in this season, I'm coming hot and heavy with this question. Is math a racist subject? Now, I know some of you all are wondering about the title, so let me give you a little bit of background. A while ago, I was on LinkedIn and I saw an article asking the question, is math a racist subject? After reading that article, I was inspired to bring this subject to the space of my podcast and wanted to answer the same question with the brilliant minds I have met in the math education space dedicated to the mission of Mastery for All. How can we teach math more equitably? How can we give access to all of our students? These are the questions we're going to be asking in that question. So I want you to be open to the things that these brilliant minds have to say, these colleagues of mine. So is math a racist subject? Well, let's find out. I'll see you on the other side of this question. Hey, everybody, welcome to another episode of Is Math a Racist Subject, brought to you by me, Mr. James O'Neill, from my podcast, Mastery for All. I'm excited to join Dr. Kimberly Melger today. Hey, Kim, how are you doing?
Hey, James, good to be here.
Good to see you. And I'm excited about us getting into the conversation. But before we get into the conversation, let me just read who I have and the brilliance I have with us today. So just a little bit about Dr. Kim. Dr. Kim is the department chair of mathematics at Relay Graduate School of Education. This is her 15th year in what she describes as the best field, which is education. Kim taught middle school math and science and served as an instructional coach in the South Bronx before joining Relay, where she has also taught aspiring teachers as an adjunct and assistant professor. Dr. Kim is passionate about all things math, including how to create inclusive math classrooms through UDL, support multilingual learners, and help teachers and students see themselves as mathematicians. So to everyone, let us welcome again, Dr. Kim.
That was a very beautiful intro there, James.
Well, you know, I got to do you right because you know, because you are she, and I can't wait to everybody to hear what your brilliance is as we approach this topic today. And so we were chatting before we started recording and said that, you know, I have some questions that I'm going to start off with, but I know the conversation is going to be rich and we're going to flow in many different avenues today. So I'm excited for everybody that's listening to really, really hear who you are and what you bring to this space called mathematics. So I'm just going to jump right in. And so the title is Math a Racist Subject? And so I just want your initial thoughts on that question. Is math a racist subject?
So when you first pitched the title to me, I was like, huh, that's such a great question. And so I'm a scientist as well. And when I think about mathematics and science, I think about the fact that it is just a way of thinking. Mathematics and science is a way of approaching how we view the world, how we may process the world, how we think about inquiry. And so in and of itself, it's not racist. Mm-hmm. The problem comes in how we decide whose interpretations of math and science we value. It comes in who we allow access to math and science. And history, you know, I'm also a historian, has lots of play there, right? For a long time, mathematics was only meant for white, wealthy men who could afford tutors and who had access to certain career paths as early as the 1900s. And so, you know, who has had access, whose thoughts were valued has always been a question. And if you look back at our history, we can find some pinpoint answers there around what changed in policy, what's changed in laws, mm-hmm. what's changed in society. And so do I think math is racist? No, I think how we interpret mathematics and who has the power in mathematics is based in racism. And there's a lot to unpack there.
Okay. And we're going to unpack some of that stuff. So initially, no, math is not racist. It is a way of thinking. What comes into play is who we give access to, who have historically had power, who we limit access to. And that's when the racism coming in. Is that what you're saying?
Yep.
Okay. So you talked about just the history of who's had access to math. And so I want to just go into what made you passionate about it, or who gave you access to it in order or for a way for you to become passionate about what you do?
That's a great question. So I think when I was a student, I was just good at it. And I don't think I was passionate, but when you're a kid and you're good at something, people tell you you're good at something and something that you're like, oh, well, this is damn good ass, so I'm going to keep doing it. Mm-hmm. And I had a teacher, Mr. Rodriguez, who I remember 12th grade calculus. He told mom, he was like, you know, Kim has like a really unique way of approaching calculus. She's like, I don't think I've ever met a student with this level of conceptual understanding of what she's doing in the moment when I was doing some kind of calc task or whatever. And I took calculus in college, and I never remember feeling that. And I remember feeling like the way I saw something brought value. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't pursue mathematics in undergrad. I took mathematics because I was a science major and statistics and things like that. But it wasn't something that I thought there was space for me in that field. It was something that I felt I could contribute to. And then I became a math teacher, and thinking about the impact that I could have on how people saw themselves in spaces, thinking about the impact that I saw and how students saw themselves within math spaces, really pushed me to reevaluate my own understanding of my identity as a mathematician and my identity in this field. And as I learned more and I learned more history and I learned more about myself and I unpacked my own experiences, and I was like, I do have a really unique perspective and I do think about mathematics differently, and it's awesome. And how can I help others feel awesome about the ways that they see mathematics and the ways they see themselves? And I think that has driven my work for the last 15 years. For both kids and adults, I think, you know, every survey that comes out is like math anxiety is on the up and up, and like 60% of people don't want to, like, are fearful of mathematics, like all the things that come up. And you're just like, if it's the majority of the population, then it's not them, right? We're doing it wrong. Mm-hmm. Like if the majority of the population is saying these things, we can't keep blaming the people. And so when I think about that, I think that drives me, and it's what continues to drive my passion. Identity work is something that has become integral to just what I bring into any space that I'm in. So yes, I teach math. Yes, I teach math pedagogy, but more importantly, I help you navigate your mathematical identity, and I help you see yourself as someone who can continue to learn and who has value in mathematics.
Yeah, I love that. You said a lot of great things. And one of the next questions I had, and I was just like, you just prompting right to it. Like, so what has been your experience in making sure that all races master math? I know you have really talked about being in place so that everyone feels welcome when it comes to this subject. You already hit on the history of who was in intended for, who the doors were swung open for. So what has been your experience in when just lifting up and making sure that everybody in your space, not just the white male, everybody in your space feels welcome in doing math?
You know, I wasn't always good at it. I remember, you know, I had a school leader call me out. It must have been my second or third year of teaching. And he was like, just so you know, lesson was great. Discussion was great. You called on like 3 times more boys than you did female students in your class as a female, right? As a as a woman in STEM. And I remember being like, ooh, like I've internalized so many messages around whose voice matters.
Yeah.
And I project those things. And so a lot of it started with like my own internal work around like monitoring what I was doing. So watching myself teach, keeping track of who I called on, thinking about feedback, who's getting what kind of feedback, who am I calling on for different types of questions? So I think a lot of it started with myself first, just understanding what were my go-to moves? And were those go-to moves equitable?
That's good.
And when they're not, how do I monitor for that so that I'm not projecting it and I can retrain my, you have to retrain your brain, right? I need to retrain my brain to see those patterns and work against those patterns, which goes against messages that I've been hearing about society and mathematics for 30 years, right? So it's really a change in mindset and a change and a retraining of my brain. And so in my work now, I have the ability to just work across states. You know, in my work at Relay, we work with teachers in, you know, more than 10 different states, different contexts. And really, it's about understanding your context. So I can't be an expert in all of my teachers' worlds because that's just not possible. I'm not building those relationships. I'm not living in those communities. And so it's really about helping teachers. The way I'm impacting this work is by helping teachers get better at understanding context, building different relationships with their students, understanding the difference between, you know, changing the names in a task and really thinking about what would be relevant to my students. Mm. What, how can I bring in all of their beautiful culture, both linguistically, families, you know, if it's a diversity of culture, how do I bring all of that into my math space so that it's valued and we show that our communities are full of mathematics. And then it's just about like figuring out how to make those two things fit. And it's less about making math fit kids, right? But how do like, how does it already exist in our kids and how does it already exist in their lives? And we can brighten those lines for them so that they're seeing those connections, they're building investment and they're not asking the question of why am I learning this, right?
Yeah.
That's going to happen with some topics, but it shouldn't be the regular. It shouldn't be the norm where kids just don't understand why they're learning mathematics for an entire, you know, 10 to 12 years of math. And so really thinking about how do we become inclusive both around who our students are and all of their beautiful spirals, who they are as learners, right? Who they are as people holistically. Yes, they're my math student. They're also a person. They have interests and hobbies and desires and goals and dreams. And how do we support all those things through mathematics? It's kind of my driving force. And so helping teachers do that work is really important to me. And it starts with me doing that work for myself so I can model it and then having them do the reflective practice of how do I do this for my students?
Yeah, I think you said something really, really good there, because that work, that internalized and just the voice that you have internalized, you don't know until, I didn't know, just like you, until you see yourself. I remember sitting in a professional development and someone was just like, and I share this story all the time when I'm facilitating, but they were saying we have to separate academic consequences with academic, well, if a kid acts up academically, that needs to be an academic consequence with that. If it's a behavior consequence, we need to give you, if it's a behavior problem, we need to give him behavior consequences. Because I was sitting in class and the way I was raised in the classroom, like you didn't talk during the test and you lost points. And so literally sitting in a class, taking off points, that's 5 points, that's 3 points, that's 2 points from a grade when it's a behavior problem. And when I looked around, just like you, I looked at who was getting all the punishment? My Black boys. Someone that I'm all been fighting for in education, I identify as a Black male. And it wasn't until I got that eye opener that I need to make sure that academic consequences go with academic behavior. I need to separate the two. I can't punish kids behaviorally for academics problems. And so, and the vice versa. And so when I was sitting in there, I saw myself, but doing that work and realizing like, whoa, I've internalized something that is hindering the very population that I signed up to help, you know?
But even in that, right, even though you should treat them separately, they're connected, right? Like Hammond talks about your safety threat system being activated, right? And this idea that like kids are having physical reactions, particularly teenagers, right? Mm-hmm. We don't understand why they're having those reactions. Adults don't even understand that, right? Kids are having physical reactions in specific spaces because of experiences that are trauma, right? Yeah. They've experienced trauma within certain spaces and they're reacting physically and behaviorally to those trauma and to those anxieties. And even though that deserves a behavioral consequence, we also don't try to address the root of those behaviors. So they don't change, right? They will continue to exasperate over time. And how do we, A, stop creating trauma for students, particularly our students of color? But additionally, how do we support students in unpacking those traumas as I would with adults, right? And help them understand what their triggers are. Okay, I am being triggered in this moment. What about this test is triggering me? Is it the content? Is it the time? Is it that I missed that homework assignment? Like, what is triggering for students? Is it I don't like my teacher? The teacher doesn't know me, so I don't want to work hard for them, because that happens too, right?
All the time.
And so it's helping kids understand what is triggering me, because it's not going to get better until it's not about consequences. It's about understanding myself as a learner and starting to address what is causing me to have these reactions in these moments. And a lot of times we rush to the consequence in the name of like order, right? We can't have kids running amok in a classroom. That's just not going to be conducive, right? And where do we find the right balance between having structure and a strong culture in a classroom and supporting students in understanding what's triggering them in those moments so they can start to unpack and address and change those behaviors, right? As we would as adults, right? As an adult, if my boss upsets me, I'm not going to go off on them. I've learned to, okay, why am I upset right now? Okay, now that I know what I'm upset about, maybe I need to communicate more effectively with my boss about X, Y, and Z.
Yeah.
That's what we want kids to be doing in math spaces as well. Otherwise, even if you are separating the consequences, you're not addressing the root cause, and it doesn't help them become the mathematician they can be once they figure that out.
That's really, really, really good. And when you were talking about that, I just thought of a student. My last year in the classroom was this past year. And my student, Chris, anytime there was a test, Chris was already a class clown. But if the test was about to happen, you were about to get another person out of him. And I immediately knew is that he did not feel confident in math. And so a test was a trigger for him. And until I sat down, like you said, and had a conversation with him about, I know why you're doing this. You don't feel comfortable. So let's build your confidence in math. And when I did that, he stopped and was just like, I may not know. I'm going to do what I can do and what I can't do. You know, I talked to his mom, got a tutor. But what you hit on is the taking the time to understand a child, which I want to go into next. Like, as your role, how do you support specifically in math? Because like you said, math trauma, math anxiety, math phobia, all the research and everybody that says when we're about to do some math, even in facilitation and PD, people start cringing. Like, what type of math? What level of math? What, you know, how do you help teachers unpack that for themselves and for their kids?
So it's a multi-level, right? So first and foremost, I think it's really important that we share stories and model that vulnerability, right? One of the things that we don't talk enough about is in order for teachers to change their practice, they have to acknowledge that what they were doing was either wrong, racist, or problematic.
Mm-hmm.
And no one's going to want to own up to that. And you have to be willing, right? Once you know better, you can do better. You have to acknowledge that you were doing something that wasn't working and might actually have been far harmful for kids. And that's really hard to acknowledge. And so we often don't give teachers that space to be vulnerable and to like acknowledge that like that practice actually was very problematic and might have hurt some kids along the way, because we're always under attack. Like the headlines, the newspaper, like teachers are always, they're selfish. They only work X amount of hours. They have summers off. But the conversations, the narratives that we share about teachers are just so problematic that on top of that, they're not going to own up to like making a mistake. Cause like, what would happen? Like we would eat them alive, right?
Cancel culture. Part of it,
Yeah. And so part of it is like, I think people in leadership modeling that vulnerability of being like, hey, you know what? Here are some things that I did in my practice in the beginning that I have changed. And here are the reasons why. So I think that's step one. I think I model that for teachers when applicable, right? I have shared the story around that student leader telling me about who I was calling on. And there are other moments in my career that I made some choices that I would never make today because now I understand the impact that those choices would have on students. The second thing is that question, always thinking about in the moment, you are going to make split second decisions, right? Teachers make hundreds of decisions an hour.
So many,
right? And they all impact students in different ways.
Yeah.
So always reflecting on in that moment, here is a choice you made. What was the impact on students, both academically, but also on students as people, right? Because sometimes it might get the kid to be quiet in the moment and it might get the kid to do the work. But did it have a secondary impact of maybe shutting that kid down in some way or making that kid feel maybe less than in that moment? Because sometimes compliance can seem like a good thing, but really you're shutting down kids, right? You're shutting them down to want to ask questions, right? I've seen this a lot where I'll observe a teacher and the kid will ask a great question, but it deviates the lesson. He just shuts that down real fast. And you see the kid kind of close up
when in reality, he was asking a great mathematical question. One that maybe you can't answer in the moment, but it'd be like, oh my God, that is a great question. We're going to explore that later today. I'm going to put it on a sticky note and you can come back to that, right? It's a very different response. So second, I think the third thing I think about is, how do we respond to students when they do things that we weren't expecting? Those can be positive things like asking great questions. They could also be not so positive things, kids shouting out, or those triggering, like those moments where they're triggered and they act out in some way, shape, or form, they become the class clown, or they're talking, or they're distracting students, or whatever it is that's happening. Thinking about, how are you in that moment reacting to that child? Are you reacting from an emotional place of, I want them to listen to me? Or are you kind of practicing that emotional consistency of like saying, okay, something is going on here. It's not personal. Let me react to the student by saying, hey, I've noticed you doing this. Tell me more about that. What's going through your mind in that moment? Which is a very different reaction, right? Like, I've had kids cuss me out in the past, right? And I remember looking at them and being like, okay, you're upset about something. I know it's not me. So if you need a minute, take a minute, but then I want you to come back and let me know what's upsetting you so we can try and fix it. And their immediate reaction is they kind of look at you funny.
Yeah.
Because they expected you to be angry. They expected me to say, get out or whatever. And that's not going to be my reaction because it's not about me, right? It's about what that student is feeling. And we work with preteens and teenagers. Like, they're feeling lots of things.
A whole bunch,
right? And so in my experience, helping teachers monitor their reactions is really interesting work because they often even realize that they're reacting from this emotional place and taking it personal and thinking about, I need to hold the line. And well, again, expectations are really important. Culture is really important. I'm not saying that they're not. I had a great culture. I had kids met expectations. But in those moments of how you react is really important to just monitor yourself. And the other thing I think is really important is we have a lot of math teachers who have different levels of positive math mindsets. Some of them were great mathematicians, but the ways of what they value in mathematics is very one-dimensional.
Yeah.
They value efficiency and accuracy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And real world mathematics is not that. So that's a mindset that's not going to breed good mindsets in kids because they're going to say, well, if I'm not efficient or fast, then I'm not good in this space. You've got teachers who didn't have great math experiences, who teach mathematics because of teacher shortages and just people not pursuing mathematics in that way. And so you have teachers who don't feel great about themselves in a math space. And they project that onto students, whether that means belittling struggle, whether that means being like, okay, don't worry if you don't get this, it's okay. No, it's not okay if you don't get this. Like, what can we do to help you, right? Is the reaction we should have. Whether it's an acceptance of failure. Like, there's a huge acceptance of failure on mathematics where people are perfectly confident being like, yeah, that's just not for me.
Right, right.
And you're like, but you're a lawyer. But you're like, I have friends who are, you know, had some very successful people and they'll say things and I'm like, huh, that's an interesting sentence to say right there. And I want to push that on that. And let's have this conversation. And, you know, or people who took career paths in order to avoid math classes in undergrad. And you're like, but you're brilliant. Like, you are truly a brilliant person. Exactly. You could have done this.
Yeah.
You could have done this. And someone along the line made you believe you couldn't. And that's the big thing. Who do you want to be in a kid's journey? Do you want to be the teacher who made them believe they couldn't? Or do you want to be the teacher who makes them believe they can?
You just said something good right there. So that is such a good question. And I think, like, even in everything that you just said, grounding yourself in that question will help you make better decisions about kids, making when you're planning in the moment when you're heated, because it does get heated. I've been in middle school for the majority of my life. Like, they love you one day and they can't stand you the next. And as an adult, like, when, like you said, cuss you out, fuss you out, and then the next day asking you for some of your food. I'm just like, did we not have issues yesterday? Like, how are you in my face asking me for some food? Or I got some candy on my desk.
Remember, every day is a new day, James. Every day is a new day
for them. And so when you said that, I want to get to this question because, you know, I'm really passionate about Black boys performing in mathematics, because anytime, and, you know, something that I always share, Dr. Kim, Whenever I facilitate, I remember facilitating you with you in LA, and you said something, and I paraphrase it, and you said, like, data can destroy dreams. Like, if you continue to put up data, and as a little Black boy, and coming into education, I always knew where Black boys would land. I already knew. Who's that dot down there? Those are Black boys. Who's the dot at the bottom? Those are Black boys. So I want to phrase this question. I don't know how much, you know, experience do you have, but I know you have experience with teaching all. Like, so how do you, what are your thoughts concerning why historically Black boys score the lowest when it comes to math proficiency?
So A, the provision gap, I think, is definitely high on the list. What types of problems we're putting in front of kids is definitely correlated to both socioeconomic status and race. And like those two things are also like kind of hand in hand, right? So when I think about conversations, I'm from the South Bronx, right? I'm from Jersey, but I work in the South Bronx. Mm-hmm. And when I think about the types of tasks people believe that my students could do, it was never grade level. It was never going to be what was appropriate for their grade level and their intellect. And so if you're never getting grade level work, how are you ever going to score well on a test? Mm-hmm. You're never going to score well on a test.
Can you say that one more time?
Yeah.
One more time.
If you're never given like the grade level work that's going to be on the test, then you're never going to score well on the test, period. Mm-hmm. Right. And so I think, and it was always surprising to people because I, you know, my school was very progressive at the time. It still is, but very progressive at the time. And I remember like, it didn't matter if you were level one, or level four, you took algebra one and you were expected to do well. And kids did well. When you raise expectations, kids meet them, assuming you're providing them with the rich tasks they deserve that are going to help them do well on tests. And so if we're always, you know, again, like it's about mindsets, right? Because what we believe about kids impacts what we put in front of them.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think when you think about that population, what kinds of work are they being asked to do? And kids get bored, and some kids have learned that when they're bored and they act out, they get to leave class. And so that happens to be sometimes or students of color where they're like, well, I'm bored. This is boring. This is fourth grade work. I'm a seventh grader. I don't want to do this. And so now you have behavior problems coming up
mm-hmm.
that wouldn't have been there if you had just gave more challenging work. And so there's a lot of times what we put in front of kids impacts behavior because some kids learn if I'm just quiet, they will ignore me. But some kids are like, no, like I'm bored, I'm gonna act out. And so, and then it relates to like suspension rates. And so all of a sudden now they're like getting suspended.
Yeah.
And everyone's like, oh, it's like a flaw of character. And I'm like, no, they're bored. I would be bored. Like I go into observe some classes and I'm like, oh my God, this is an algebra one class. Why are they doing fractions?
Right.
Why?
That's always the go-to. Fractions.
And the kids are like, it's like their eyes are like bleeding and they're like, they are acting out. And I'm like, I would be acting out too. I've got some severe ADD. Like I would have thrown a pencil at the teacher as well. Like I would have thrown a pencil at you if you were my teacher. And they don't see that. They don't see that as the problem. They're like, but they don't understand fractions. Do they not understand? Is that really what the problem is? Do they need fractions, understand functions? Questionable. No, like, and so there's this conversations you have to have around our beliefs about what content is important, our beliefs about what it means to do mm-hmm. mathematics is another like big philosophical question. I love asking people because it tells me a lot about what I'm going to see on the video based on their response.
Yeah.
So I think that answers your question in a kind of roundabout way, but it's really about what we put in front of kids.
Right.
Impacting their ability to do well.
I love your answer. And I want to take it a different route because not just what we put in front of kids, but while you was talking, I really thought about the fact that as a Black man showing up in a space in mathematics, few far in between. Like, yeah, there's a whole bunch of diversity in Charlotte, but I remember living in Pittsburgh and being the only Black male in the entire mm-hmm. district. You know, and because there's boroughs and different things, just like in New York, there's boroughs. You can go to a different borough, and just depends on the population there. So when you said what we put in front of kids, I thought about you putting you in front of kids, like who you are as a Hispanic female, as a doctor in this space yeah. of mathematics. How has your journey been when kids see you, specifically kids of color?
Yeah, it's a, It's a really loaded question, James, because I'm on this identity journey myself. So something that's in my Latinidad is something that I didn't unpack for a long time. I was raised, keep your head down, work hard, bootstraps, race mm-hmm. doesn't exist. That is how I was raised. Also, the Latina, we often, I don't know what box to check. Like, I'm not Black, I'm not white, but kind of white because colonialism, you know, Central America,
yeah.
but really like indigenous as well, because my grandma's indigenous. So like I am confused about what I am sometimes. And that's something that I've been unpacking a lot over the last, I would say, 7 or 8 years or so. And
got you.
I'm married to a Black man, and he's very secure in who he is as a Black man. He's been having these conversations since he could talk. And so it's interesting to talk to him about this, because he's like, wait, you never talked about that with your mom? And I was like, no, my mom is still colorblind. Like, we're not having that conversation at the dinner table. And so I don't think I realized or understood the impact that I had in those spaces for a long time. I just was showing up and doing what I thought was best for kids and, you know, really making sure that they felt seen and heard and loved and cared for in those spaces. But as I have begun to unpack this journey, and I think conversations with people like you and my students, my teacher students, you know, I've had them be like, I've never had a professor who looked like me. I have never, tell me more about how you got your doctorate. Like, I didn't know that was a possibility for me. Like, I want to learn more.
Wow.
And through those like conversations, I'm like, oh, I matter. Mm. Like, I know I matter, but like me showing up as my full self and having my pronouns be she, ella, matters to people in a certain space. It allows them to see, oh, she's there. I can be there too. And I don't think I had thought about that impact for most of my career because of just how I was raised to not really think about that as like a part of who I am.
Yeah.
And it's been an interesting journey for me that I've been reflecting on. And then it's something that I'm like, do I need to be flexing it more? Do I need to be putting my foot in more doors? So, and that's something that I've been thinking a lot about too. Like, even in my leadership role, I'm still one of the few Latinas in leadership roles in the institutions that I work for. And that's not the case for, you know, we have a lot of like Black males and females in leadership roles. And like, that's just not the case for Latinos. And so it's been interesting for me to kind of reflect on that and how sometimes for Latinos, we're hidden in the conversation. And just what does that mean for me in this work? Because obviously what's happening to our Black boys in America is just, it's scary. I'm raising a biracial boy. He's half Black.
Yeah.
And, you know, the conversations that Reggie will have to have with him at some point about like, what does it mean to be out late at night? What do you do if someone stops you? Like, those are conversations that he's going to have with our son. And like, why? Why is that a reality today in 2030? I know that's still going to be a conversation we have to have.
Yeah.
And so all that's kind of wrapped in. So I'm unpacking my identity in a lot of ways. It's been a journey that I'm on. It's exhausting to be on that journey and just unpacking what that means for me and my work and showing up into spaces and really uplifting those that have been put down for so long.
Yeah. Yeah. I know, like you said, first of all, you do matter. As I think sometimes, you know, being in this Black space, everything becomes about the advancement of Black people. And we sometimes forget that we are a part of the people of color. And I started to really think when I came into the school that I was at the last time, my last years in education, as far as being a teacher, classroom teacher, I was just like, I have so many Latino, Latinas, Hispanic students. And I'm just like, when do they get to see themselves? Like outside of teaching Spanish or a world language like that. And I remember that one teacher came into our school, a math teacher, Ms. Chavez, and I was doing this speech and I came off stage and I was like, this is why I'm here. She came to me and she was just like, I'm here for the same reason that you are, because our kids need to see people like us in this space. And I look at what I remember having parents come to me during open house when I lived in Pittsburgh. And because my name is James O'Neill, you don't know, like, you don't know who you're getting. And so they come to the door and just be like, we didn't know you were here. Like grandmas, mamas, everybody used to say that because it's just like the joy of having someone in this space that may not, we're not a monolith. None of us are. We have some similar journeys, but we're on our own separate journeys. But the fact that they saw me, it did something to their heart. And so I'm just going to echo what everybody's saying about you. When you show up in those spaces, it really does something into the hearts of people that look like you, reminded like females, everybody, because you're not just showing up because I'm here. I didn't get a card. You're brilliant and you're going and you're effective. So I just want to echo that before I move on to the last question that I really.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. When I think about math education as a whole, you said a lot, even how we can support teachers and support our students. What is your personal mission as it relates to mathematics education?
Right. It evolves. If you ask this question a year, it'll probably be a little different. Mm-hmm. But right now, my mission in this world is to just help everyone see themselves as contributing members to mathematics. Mm. Doesn't matter if you're 5, doesn't matter if you're 55. You have something to contribute to this field in how you think about mathematics, how you use mathematics, how you use it to make sense of the world. And I want everyone to feel that. So part of that is being inclusive, right? Making sure that I'm thinking about my culture and linguistically diverse learners, thinking about my students who might have different learning needs. But at the end of the day, it's you are a person, you belong here, and I want you to feel like you belong here. And I think that's an empowering feeling that I don't know if I can do it by myself. I really need a lot of help. I hope my teachers are, you know, and that's why I work with teachers, because that's going to, you know, make my impact exponentially bigger. But that's what I want. I want to really help everyone in my life and let people that come into my circle see how their contributions be valued in a mathematics setting. And feel good about mathematics and not say I'm not a math person and not feel anxious and not send me the bill when dinner's over, like, no, I could do this. You know, it's that's what I want. I want people to feel and identify as a mathematician in the same way that identifies a historian and a scientist and a writer and a reader, like identifies all those things. I am all those things.
Yeah.
I am focused in mathematics, but I am all those other things too.
I love that for you. I love that for the people that you work with. It's so powerful. And as we were talking just today, just the math identity, I feel like I can love math even as I've called myself a math teacher, but I've never called myself a mathematician. And so even updating your math identity has had a positive impact on what I see. I can call myself a poet. I do poetry. I do spoken word. But it's almost like in the very beginning when you first started talking, what is a mathematician? Oh, it's someone, this white dude that's who we name. We're going to name all the people that we talk about. But someone who loves math, does math, proficient in math, and continues to grow in math is a mathematician. And so thank you for.
And you're not alone. If you Google mathematician, those are the pictures that pop up, right? Yeah. It's not me. It's not you.
Yeah.
But we are.
Yeah.
Google hasn't caught up yet.
Yeah. And we're gonna help Google and all AIs and all the stuff that's coming up. We're gonna help them see us in this space. Dr. Kim, this has been rich. It's been great. And just to rebound back to what you said at the beginning, math is not a racist subject. It is about who we have historically given access and promoted as it relates to math. And so I have you're the second person that I've talked to about this. And so I have one person said, yes, it is. And you're saying, no, it's not. So I appreciate you lifting up your brilliance and being with me today. This is Mr. O'Neill with Mastery for All. Thank you all for joining and have an amazing day.
Man, oh man, I hope, listen, you got everything you needed from this episode. And I also hope that you got some clarity as far as, is math a racist subject and how we can do better with the teaching of mathematics. As you already know, I'm a speaker, coach, consultant, and PD/workshop provider. I would love to partner with you and your school, your district, or maybe even your organization as it relates to supporting the mastery of mathematics for all of our students. Feel free to reach out to me through email at info@MrJamesO'Neal.com or check out other resources at my website at MrJamesO'Neal.com. Follow me on Instagram or Facebook at Mr.JamesO'Neal or LinkedIn and Twitter at MrJamesO'Neal without any dot. Listen, I am super excited that you decided to join me. Today. Have an amazing day.